pushing paper, swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how alive you felt down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics for Harper's. He edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and is the director of the Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case of Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Good to be here.
And the Dallas Fed just issued a report a couple of days ago, which was quite alarming. Not that we didn't know about the damage done to the economy from the 2008 financial crash. Their study is called How Bad Was It? The Cost and Consequences of the 2007-2009 Financial Crisis. They put a conservative estimate of the damage to the U.S. economy at $14 trillion, or roughly 1 year of U.S. GDP. So when in your last book you talk about the triumph of finance and the decline of America, nothing is more stark than those figures.
Well, you know, it's interesting that economists rarely talk about the cost of recessions or financial crises. In fact, there's an economic school of thought, unsurprisingly, coming out of Chicago and Minnesota and places like that, universities of, that recessions don't matter, that the losses really are not of consequence and are made up on the way back up. I think this crash was so severe that it is hard to be blithe about the losses due to recessions and financial crises. And it's interesting that the Dallas Fed is doing it because they are a pretty conservative lot. I've had my run-ins over cost of living, standard of living issues with them before. They tended to be afraid of inflation under every mattress and didn't want much stimulus, usually, in their past. So it's interesting that they have seen it, found it necessary to talk about the enormous hit this economy took due to the crash, the financial crash, and the losses of homes and the losses of borrowing power and so forth, and the recession itself, the soaring unemployment, the lack of investment, the fact that wages are not going up on average and therefore going down for lots of people, long-term unemployment. These are enormous costs that stay with us over time, and it's something economists are starting to pay attention to, but should be paying far more attention to. And it says something about the economics profession that they haven't done much of that before.
But what's happened in post-2008 crash has been that Wall Street got rewarded for almost destroying the global economy, and the public who paid for to make them whole has been punished. And even the Dallas Fed points out that the recovery from the financial crisis has been much, much slower than any other recovery since World War II. And that is obviously to do with the way that the Republicans have seized on this as a reason to cut the deficits caused by the bailout to rescue Wall Street and have prevented any real stimulus to rescue Main Street. So I find it extraordinary that the president has been able to – I guess he's too complicit in helping Wall Street.
I think he was complicit. You know, of course, the famous book by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff called This Time is Different, that traces a lot of banking crises, always there was a very slow economic recovery after those crises. But they are very explicit in this that book, and you will rarely hear in journalistic accounts or even economists' accounts of the book the following. They say nothing about the effects of economic policy that was adopted after those crises. For the most part, no economic policy of expansion was adopted over those crises. After those crises historically, Keynes is a rather new development, John Maynard Keynes, Keynesianism. So, and even both of them urged stimulus. But now, because of that, because Republicans have focused on the size of the deficit, almost entirely caused by the recession itself, reducing income and therefore tax revenues, and also the war spending, and in addition, the George Bush tax cuts from way back 10 years ago, that produced a very large deficit, and it became a lightning rod for Republicans to claim we've got to reduce the size of government. That led to de-stimulus, sequestration, and so forth. But we have to keep in mind what you mentioned at the end of your last comment. To what degree was Obama complicit in this? To a great degree is the answer. A few days before he was inaugurated in 2009, he called for a fiscal responsibility conference to focus on the deficit, as the economy was falling apart. We can't focus on stopping a deficit when the economy is falling apart. In fact, we have to probably increase it a little bit at that time to get the economy going again. So Obama started it off, talked about, and Larry Summers and all those people were there. Larry Summers is being talked about as the new Fed chairman. They were there. You know, they're his advisors. Where the heck were they? Then finally he comes up with that stimulus, which was too little. It wasn't too late, but it was too little. He could have gone back a second time. He hardly ever talked about the stimulus again. And even Alan Blinder, who's a moderate left-of-center Democrat, says in his new book, he was a Fed vice chairman for a while, and he's a professor, for instance, says in his new book that all that bashing of the word stimulus made it impossible, at least in Obama's mind, to talk about stimulus again. So Obama, well, to put it politely, screwed up big time. And his advisors, I would think, screwed up big time as well. We don't have adequate information about what they were talking about at that time. But I think they were worried about deficits. Larry Summers and Bob Rubin in Clinton's administration, even when they had surpluses, were spending their surpluses on paying down debt instead of much-needed public investment in infrastructure and education.
Which, of course, is what the president spoke about yesterday in his grand bargain. Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics at Harper's. He edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and is the director of Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His latest book is Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. So the president was on the Hill today talking to Democrats who gave him an earful about Larry Summers, clearly not a popular choice. And then yesterday in Chattanooga, Tennessee, he made his big pitch for a grand bargain, the way he would cut U.S. corporate tax rates and use billions of dollars in revenues generated by a business tax to overhaul, create jobs and overhaul infrastructure and invest in infrastructure in the United States. And most of his pitch was about rescuing the middle class. And so, in other words, it's taken all this long to forget about Wall Street, who have been rewarded, and focus on Main Street, who have been punished. But what I find amazing, Jeff Madrick, is that the idea of this vast American middle class in itself is something of a myth, because the recent report from the AP indicates that 4 out of 5 Americans have experienced essentially poverty, near poverty, homelessness, and have had to turn to government assistance at some point.
Or joblessness at some point.
Joblessness, yeah. So isn't it fascinating to think that 50% of Americans consider themselves middle class, and that's why, obviously, Obama is appealing to them, but nobody wants to deal with the reality that most of Americans aren't in the middle class?
Well, you raise a very good point, Ian. I think we need more data on this, but there's no question. Long ago, Bob Kuttner talked about the hollowing out of the middle class. So the middle class remains a useful mythology for Democrats who are, in fact, afraid to talk to the public about helping poor people or struggling people.
Well,
so this whole
people,
middle-out strategy, which in a way I agree with, because it's really talking about wages and raising wages to lead the economy back to prosperity. I agree with that, but the idea that it's about, you know, creating or reinforcing the middle class is kind of a political trick. Not even kind of, it's a political trick. We've got an awful lot to do. I think a lot of Obama's programs are correct. I think, sadly, he leaves out curing what I think is the biggest problem in America, child poverty. We have the largest child poverty rate in the world, which I know you've talked about often. But he's been trying to reverse the sequestration stuff, these automatic cuts, since early this year. And somewhere along the line, he did start talking about jobs, I think, sometime in early 2012 or 2011. But he flips back and forth on it, deficits, jobs, and so forth. The irony is the journalistic reports had it that the Obama administration was the first to bring up and propose sequestration when we had that government debt showdown back in 2011 that led to this horrible situation we're in. We're adopting full-fledged austerity economics. Not as bad as Europe, thank goodness, but we are really cutting off our nose to spite our faces by reducing government stimulus at a time when we should be increasing it, and slowing down an economy that's just possibly catching on and keeps being knocked down by these hard asses in Congress. I hope I can say that on your radio station.
Well, Jeff Madrick, what's extraordinary, though, is that when the Democrats celebrate bipartisanship, as they did recently on the immigration bill, what they don't want to mention is that they've got taken by the Republicans, that the reason that they were able to pass that immigration bill in the Senate was because all the money that was taken out of the Pentagon in sequestration, the Republicans put back into that bill in the form of so-called strengthening the border. So their backers, their financiers for the Republican hirelings in the Congress were taken care of. Now, when the president comes out and says he wants to take care of the middle class again, first of all, Boehner doesn't even return his calls when he gives him a heads up that he's going to make this speech. And then Boehner comes out and says, oh, you know, the president, I just read about it in the papers. He didn't inform me in advance about this. And apparently they did. Boehner doesn't return Obama's calls. So there you have the dysfunction. But you also have the attitude, which is bipartisanship has become, when the Democrats get hosed by the Republicans, that's bipartisanship. But when the White House suggests something that should be done, it's dead on arrival.
Yeah, well, the bipartisanship has been a nasty joke on Obama from the very beginning. That's why he made all those concessions on the stimulus bill in the first place. And he kept making concessions, and I just don't know what was in his head. He had no sense of the nature of these Republicans. He had some arrogant notion he could talk anybody into anything. I think that's from teaching too often. It's easy to talk to your students into something because they want an A from you.
But what can the Democrats do? I mean, everybody says they got to get tough, they got to man up. But what can they do?
They can get rid of the filibuster.
Right.
Which they're loath to do. You know, they keep saying the filibuster is, it'll come back to haunt us when we're the majority and they're the minority. Well, you know, it's mostly been used, as Tom Harkin, the senator, the fine senator, always says, it was originally really designed to stop desegregation, to stop integration and maintain segregation. It's mostly been used by the right wing, not the left wing. And it's become totally debilitating in terms of getting anything done in Congress. So I would certainly start there. Get rid of the darn filibuster.
But what do you do about the House, though? What do you do?
Well, the House, you've got to win back. I just don't know what you do. If they have enough defeats, now in some cases they've been splitting off. They're splitting off on the NSA to some degree. I know you've just said something interesting about immigration, but they're splitting off to some degree on those kinds of issues. So if the Senate gets a little more juice, a little more power to pass legislation, I think the House is going to have to come along and compromise a little bit. And it could be that people are getting tired of these extreme right-wingers in their party, and they may start to isolate them, but you know, now it's partly wishful thinking on my part. If we continue, you know, their objective, as we know and as you've talked about often, is to keep Obama from getting elected. So they just don't want to see a good economy. And he's got to fight them on that. I think we've got a chance to have a decent economy, even with sequestration. So things are not all bleak. And parts of Obamacare are going to work. You have some benefits there in California I've been reading about in terms of insurance costs. They're going to try to stop that, but I don't think they'll be able to defund that. At least that's what people more knowledgeable politically than myself tell me. So it's not all bleak, I don't think. There are some breaks in the clouds, but it's still mostly clouds.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, who writes a column on economics for Harper's and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and is the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. But how does the president frame this argument? I mean, obviously, it's a politically wise to continue to talk about the myth of the middle class, although, as you point out, Democrats should really talk about that they're in it to support working Americans, which in the post-Clinton Democratic Party, since they pivoted to Wall Street, is becoming something of a lie. But just as accepting that they want to propagate this myth of the vast middle class and they're scared of standing up for the rank and file who vote Democrat, how do you deal with the sort of delusions that, you know, 50% of the country think they're in the middle class when 80% of them are actually in the working class? And even within the Pew study that was done last year that came up with these figures, 6% of those earning over $100,000 consider themselves to be lower class, while another 6% of those earning less than $30,000 consider themselves to be in the upper class. So clearly there's no consensus on what on class. And frankly, my argument would be, Jeff Madrick, that what we really need in this country is affirmative action based on class, not on race.
Well, I do think jobs, subsidies for lower-income people make sense. But, I guess if I had to adopt phrases that might work and are true, I would be talking about decent jobs are a basic human right. I wouldn't be talking about middle versus who knows what. Decent jobs are a human right, and we have fewer and fewer decent jobs in America, and we need an America that creates decent jobs. It's about human dignity. It's about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's about it's not about social class and narrow economic ideas and government deficits. It's about what America should be. There should be a decent job for every person who wants them. To some degree, that might involve government creating jobs, police corps, education corps, infrastructure, construction corps, and so forth, a la the New Deal. Why the heck not?
Well, it's sort of what he talked about yesterday in Chattanooga. But, of course, he made his pitch for the grand bargain at the Amazon warehouse in Chattanooga. And I'm not sure that warehouse jobs are the – I mean, maybe they are the future, but they certainly aren't exactly –
Well, they've knocked the heck out of – what do they call that? The Midland Empire in California or something that are all warehouse jobs.
Right.
And all those cities are going bankrupt. But the you know, his chief economist, Jason Furman, once wrote a paper in support of Walmart, so I'm not so surprised. But that's the pitch I would use. I wouldn't talk about middle class, and then you need the programs to do it. And it's not just education. It's actually going out and creating decent jobs. It's giving job subsidies to companies to create jobs. It's getting that money back from overseas and taxing it properly and using it for retraining and proper education. My own view, which is not one that's talked about very much, is child poverty is a critical and tragic issue. You can have all the decent pre-K and K through 12 you want, but when you bring up one-fourth of your children in poverty, they are nutritionally, psychologically, emotionally deprived. They don't have any reason to be optimistic. They don't have a reason to dream. How are they going to latch onto even an improved K through 12 or pre-K through 12 education system? You hardly get economists talking in those terms. They have such narrow views. Improve education, they say, and with no sense of the fight people have for a decent life now.
Well, Jeff Madrick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics for Harper's, edits Challenge magazine, and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books. He's the director of the Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and is a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case for Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm